Alec. And it's a privilege to be here. My sponsor always said, when you talk from the podium, wear a tie. It's my least favorite thing to do in life. Very least favorite thing to do in life. But I respect Alcoholics Anonymous. And let's see, my sobriety date is January 22nd, 2011, and I have 13 and a half years. And, you know, I'll stick to what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, I believe I was an alcoholic before I ever picked up a drink. I did a lot of things alcoholically before I ever drank. And, you know, I grew up in a large family. I was the youngest of seven kids. My parents were alcoholics, and I started everything really young. I think the first time I got loaded, I was eight. We stole a boat, went across the lake, and went to a Hell's Angels party back east. And that was my introduction. Yeah, I started out with a bang, and I remember I smoked three joints, and I drank a bunch of beers, and I woke up the next morning in my bed soaking wet, and my sibling said, yeah, you fell out of the boat, dummy, you almost drowned, and I couldn't wait to do that again. And I was just getting started, and I wasn't an alcoholic and an addict. Drugs are a part of my story. I really appreciate the singleness of purpose. My sponsors have always taught me to respect the house I'm in. I just qualified to be in a lot of houses, I'll just say that. And but, you know, I started drinking at a young age, and I started really wanting to escape. I just didn't feel like I fit in where I was. I felt like I was in the wrong family. Just things just didn't feel right. And I really started getting loaded a lot when I was, you know, a teenager. I was 16 years old, and I was put in a psych ward for a severe drug and alcohol overdose. And they didn't really have rehabs back then, so they stuck me in the psych ward, and I was 17, and I had teachers bringing me schoolwork while I was in the psych ward, and I was there for about two and a half months, and I had psychiatrists and psychologists and therapists telling me that, you know, for your age, you have a really huge problem with alcohol and with drugs, and little did I know, I was just getting started. I'm one of these people, I don't want to sound unique or anything, but I was a chronic relapser in Alcoholics Anonymous for almost 24 years. And I don't know if you have people speak at roundups and at conventions that are chronic relapses, but here I am. And, you know, I, for some reason, God plopped me in the rooms 24 years before I was ready to have that surrender that it takes to sufficient enough to stay here. And I don't know why that was, but I was learning stuff along the way. I was the guy that people said, Ray, he's a really nice guy, but if you want to stay sober, don't do what that guy's doing. I was that guy. They used to call me the Ray Walker instead of the Jay Walker. And I grew up on the East Coast. I ended up graduating. I don't even know how that happened. I graduated high school and moved up to Seattle and ended up down in Santa Barbara, and that's where my disease really kicked into full gear in Santa Barbara, and I was, I got a job in aerospace. I was working with Hughes Aircraft and with Raytheon, and I was with them for about 8 years, and I was really progressing in this company, and getting loaded the whole time. I don't even know how I managed to keep this job, but I was really climbing the ladder. I was getting clearances and secret clearances and top secret clearances, and I was flying around the country working on all this stuff that went on satellites and blah blah blah, and then I heard that they were, and so I had a career kind of getting built up there, and then the word got out that they were going to start drug testing, and it's like there was no way I was a huge pothead back then, and there was no way I was going to stop doing that, and I left that. I just turned and walked away from that career, and I ended up starting my own business, and I've had my own business for 40 years. I've recently retired. But, you know, there's more value in talking about, for me, I was thinking about this, there's more hope and value in talking about what it's like now, because, You know, for nearly 24 years, I wasn't one of those alcoholics or those relapses that would relapse and stay away for long periods of time. For some reason, my higher power had me tethered to Alcoholics Anonymous. It just had me. When I first got here, I started out in NA, or CA actually. I would go to NA so I could drink. And then when that got out of hand, I would go to AA so I could use. I mean, I was not well at all. I really, really, I kind of used these rooms for I used Alcoholics Anonymous like urgent care. I would come in here just enough to clean stuff up, and then I would be off and running again, and I just thought the word functioning alcoholic is a really dangerous word for me to use for myself, because I always thought that as long as I had a job and as long as I had money in the bank, I would just come in here to clean up wreckage. And I always had my disease for some sick way, I don't know why, I would attach my bank account to my disease. And when I was doing okay financially, I just didn't feel as alcoholic. And today, and I learned that almost killed me, having that attitude, I learned today they have nothing to do with each other. They have absolutely nothing to do with each other. I remember thinking that it was a requirement to have a really shitty, miserable childhood. That was a requirement to be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I started hearing people come in that had wonderful childhoods, and they had everything, you know, offered to them. And I hated hearing that because it I don't know how to describe it, except it took the wind out of my victim sail, you know? It was like, today I understand what makes me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is what happens to me when I ingest alcohol. That's what, I have a twofold disease. I've never had a relapse that didn't cross my mind before it crossed my lips. It always started here. Always, always, always. And so anyways, I was in and out a lot and kept trying. People were so kind to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't ever want to pass judgment on somebody that doesn't get this thing right away, because people were so kind. I remember I would attend a big Friday night Santa Barbara meeting, and somebody nominated me to do the coffee commitment. There was about four or five coffee people, and they nominated me to do the coffee commitment. And my first question was, well, how long is the commitment? And they said, you know, it's a year, Ray. Normally it's a year, but we want you to keep this commitment until you get a year. And I made coffee for that meeting for 5 years. I made coffee for that meeting for 5 years. And when I think back on that, it was like they weren't throwing me away. They weren't telling me I wasn't good enough. They were hoping I was going to get it. Because what happens to us all, no matter how much of a hip, slick, and cool relapser you think you are, the one thing that you cannot prevent is my alcoholism was progressing. Well, whether I was showing up here or not, my alcoholism was progressing, and it was progressing really, really quickly. And my blackouts were getting horrendous. They were getting really, really scary. I was a major blackout drinker. I would start doing things like coming out of blackouts and hearing the pilot say, we're making our final descent into Logan Airport, and the last thing I remember, I was drinking in a bar in Ojai. And when I think about that, that's a lot of intense. I mean, you got to drive to LAX, you got to get on a plane, you got to book it, blah, blah, blah. I started doing that a lot, and it was really, really scary. And so, you know, I'm so grateful for the sponsors I had over the years, particularly the ones that said, you know, you're not ready, Ray, I can't work with you anymore. Those were the ones that had an impact on me, not the ones that coddled me, not the ones that, you know, it was really hard to... You know, I'll just say this. You know, for 24 years, pretty much I was raising my hand. In those 24 years, I think the longest I ever had was 3 years. So I was in and out a lot, and one day I stopped raising my hand and I started to stay here. So I got asked that question a lot, what happened? And I know exactly what happened. I had that. Today I know it was a spiritual experience that I had. I remember the meeting I was at. I was at a 7 a.m. meeting in Santa Barbara, and I came into the rooms. I was on a 7-day run. I was a mess. I crawled into that room, and I sat down, and I I had this overwhelming feeling that, you know what, Ray, you're going to die an alcoholic and an addict. You're either going to die a clean and sober one, or you're going to die a loaded one and a drunk one. But that's never going to change. I never drank since that day, and that was 13 and a half years ago. And that was my first step. And it went, because for 24 years, I know up here that I'm an alcoholic. But those words that they have in the reading to our innermost selves, those are very important words. Because when I admitted that, it went from here to here, that's when the miracle happened for me. My obsession to drink was lifted. And it was almost like God put, I like to say, it was like my higher power put a different set of ears on my head. And I've been sitting in meetings for 24 years, but it was like I was in my very first meeting when I had that surrender. The first thing that happened, it felt like it was a privilege to be here and not a curse. It felt like I was one of the lucky ones to sit in these chairs and not one of the cursed ones. I started relating to people. I started to believe people. I remember, I used to hate happy sober people. I could not stand happy sober people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They were like, I don't know what it was, but, and especially when people would say, I love my life. I thought, you know what? That dude's lying. That he's either lying or he's drinking in between meetings, because there's no way that you cannot drink and use and love your life. I did not think that was a possibility. I seriously did not think that was a possibility. And today, I'm one of those happy sober people that love my life. And I realized about 13 years into this thing of running in and out of here, I realized the people that were saying, I love my life, they were the people that were staying here. They were not the people that were bouncing in and out of here. And something started to shift for me. I'm a hard nut to crack, apparently. And it took a lot for me to get broken down to that point of surrender. But once I had that point of surrender, that's when miracles started to happen for me in these rooms. And one of them I want to talk about service, because the last time I came in, my last drunk, I'll talk about that. My last drunk, I was with my partner I met my partner and I brought him to his first meeting, and he's never drank again. He just celebrated 25 years last week. And I was in and out for another 13 years. Every time I get a chip, I want to give him a medal, by the way. But I remember, and we had split up because of my drinking. I mean, you can only so many times say, I'm going to Circle K for a pack of cigarettes, and call him 3 days later saying, I'm in Boston, I don't know how I got here. I mean, that was my life. I was just always disappearing. And so anyways, my last drunk, I was living alone now. I had nobody in my life. There's a place up in the mountains behind Ojai called Shyduck. It's a place, it's a big party place. And I used to go up there and party a lot. And I was up there at the bar, and I'm drinking, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to go to Seattle. I'm going to drive to Seattle. I had a lot of family in Seattle. And I thought, when I leave here, by the time, and I had no clothes. I had no suitcase. I was just going to drive to Seattle. I did that kind of stuff a lot. And I thought, you know, by the time I drive through the Lockwood Valley and get to Fraser Park, when I hit the five, when I hit the Grapevine, I'm either going to go north and keep going to Seattle, or I'm going to go south and get on 126 and come home. That was my plan. That was my drunken plan. And I remember I was driving through the Lockwood Valley, and I remember vaguely I got a flat tire. And I remember getting out of my car, and that's the last thing I remember. And the next thing I remember is I woke up in my home under my dining room table with a blanket and a pillow, like that's where I'm supposed to go to bed. I woke up under my dining room table, and I looked out in my driveway, and I saw my car, and it had a donut tire on it, a spare donut tire, and my car was covered. It looked like a little kindergarten's kids project. It was covered with handprints. And those handprints were from me falling down and getting back up. And I don't even know how I managed to change that tire. Got through the Grapevine, got home. And for some reason, I'd been driving in blackouts for almost 40 years. For some reason, that scared the hell out of me. I have no recollection of changing that tire. I have no recollection of driving through the mountains, through the Grapevine, back up into Ojai. Zero. I have zero recollection of that. And for some reason, that morning, that scared the hell out of me. And I went to that meeting in Santa Barbara, and I had that spiritual awakening. And I think, so people ask me, you know, what was that, what was missing? Because, I mean, in that 24 years, I would have sponsors, I would work my steps half-ass. You know, that when they say half measures availed us nothing, they really mean it. It availed me nothing. I always left stuff out of my fourth step. Another thing I will say is, most of the things that I thought I knew when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous have turned out to be the opposite. They have completely turned out to be the opposite. And what I mean by that is, you know, when they would say, you know, when you leave stuff out of your fourth step, you know, are you sure to drink? We're not sure if you're sure to drink, but there's a possibility you will. And I thought, nah, that's bullshit. I can leave this out and I won't drink. I always drink. I always drink. It's really, they really mean it when they say you're as sick as your secrets. I always left a fifth step. I always left my sponsor's house with some secrets. Always, 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 always. And I always got loaded again. And the last time I did a fifth step, there's nothing that I know that I left out of it. And I haven't drank since then. I know that to be a fact. So they really mean what they say in the big book, you know? And anyways, when I went to that meeting and I had that spiritual awakening, I went back to Ojai, and the next morning I went to the to our Olano Club at the 6 a.m. meeting, and I got this sponsor. I love this guy. He was he's not with us anymore, but he was Tony Kay from Camarillo, and he I called him every morning, and I would complain. I'm like, God, our Olano Club is so nasty. It's the nastiest place. I feel like I'm going to catch an STD just sitting down in this place. It's so gross. And he goes, well, why don't you do something about it? I'm all, I don't know, what do you mean, why don't I do something about it? I was unemployable at the time, and I owned my own business, so that ought to tell you where I was at. I was just a mess. And he goes, well, why don't you fix the place up? And so I went to the board. They had a board meeting there, and I said, you know, I'd like to offer, I was a painting contractor. I said, I'd like to offer to paint this place and just clean it up. And they said, oh, that would be great. And I said, and so I did that. Anyways, long story short, I ended up staying in that club for 3 months, solid. Raised $50,000, remodeled this entire club, and there's a plaque on the wall thanking me and stuff. And I realized today, you know, the club thinks, oh, that was such a nice thing to do. I'm the one that got the benefit from that service work. For 3 months, I detoxed there. I went to three meetings a day, because I could only remodel it, and we put new flooring, we did everything to that place, and we could only do it in between meetings. So I lived there literally for 3 months, and while that was happening, I was getting a foundation going. I was developing a lot of friendships. I was in touch with my sponsor every day. I would call him, and I like to say this, I would call him with the list. You know, the list we call with our sponsors of the shit that's going on and the shit that's wrong. I would call him and I wanted to go over the list with him. And he would stop me halfway down the line, like, I can't pay my mortgage, blah, blah, blah. He would stop me and goes, did you go to the club this morning? Are you working at the club today? Did you offer a newcomer a ride today? And it's like, this dude's not listening to my list. I got a list here. And I know, today I know what he was doing. I recently heard somebody say that in Texas, they have, in meetings, they have this saying that if you want to see your crops grow, if you want your crops to grow, go paint the barn. And everyone in the meeting goes, oh, that's so cool. I didn't get what that meant until the next day. I remember it was about the list. The details of my list did not matter. It was like, go to meetings, help someone else, be of service, and the list straightens out itself. It just straightens out itself. That's what that ended up meaning to me. And so when I look back, you know, remodeling that Olano Club was the best gift I could have ever gotten, because I stayed somewhere long enough to start I think I think one reason why it was so hard for me to get sober is I started getting loaded so young. I did not know how to handle life. I didn't know how to handle any feelings. Most of it was fear. I was afraid. Every time I got sober, life got so painful for me that it's like my head would automatically say, if this is sobriety, you people can have it, because I can't handle it. I don't know how to do it. What I know how to do is numb. I know how to do numb, and numb works for me. But what happens when your alcoholism progresses is numb starts eventually, it numbed the pain, but after a while it numbed anything good also. I was just numb. There was no joy, there was nothing happy about my life. It was just numb, and that's a miserable, miserable way to live. So anyways, that was one experience I got from doing service work. Another one was, I met this lady in the Alano Club in Ojai, and she was visiting from Alaska. And she was asked to lead the meeting, and she says, and she has 52 years, she's one of my dearest friends today. She goes, I'm gonna run this meeting the way we run it in Juneau. I'm gonna ask people with 10 years or more to share. And I thought, I was still bouncing in and out of there at the time. I was still bouncing in and out of there at the time. I'd met her right before I had that spiritual experience, and I thought, boy, if I lived in Juneau, I'd be dead because I would never share because I can't get any time, blah, 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 blah. Anyways, we started talking and she had just written a book called The Wisdom of the Grandmothers, and she did a documentary on it, and she asked me, she started in Russia, and she came all the way through the United States and ended up at the tip of Argentina interviewing grandmothers, a lot of them Native American women, and it's an awesome book. And she asked me, she goes, all of the grandmothers are meeting in Alaska, and if I paid your way, would you be willing to come and kind of schlep all their suitcases? And I thought, yeah, I'll do that. I've never been to Alaska, so I did that. We flew up there, and it was such an awesome experience. When she was down in Argentina, she met with the elders of the Mayan tribe, and they had this staff they made that traveled around the world. It went everywhere, and people would attach things to it and pray with it. And it was a staff. It was about this tall, and people in AA would actually put a chip on it. And the elders of this tribe realized it never been to Alaskan soil, and they asked her if she'd take this staff. So that was part of our thing. We drove to Seattle, flew to Alaska, and we started doing all these ceremonies in all these remote villages in Alaska. It was awesome, and I fell in love with the Native American people. I just fell in love with their culture and their beliefs. And one of these ceremonies was at a domestic violence shelter for women and kids. And I met the supervisor of the place there, and it's a huge problem. I mean, these are big shelters there. It's bulletproof glass. It's a huge, huge problem up there. Anyways, to try to make this a shorter story, I ended up doing a lot of volunteer work in these shelters. I did 4 or 5 trips to Alaska, and I would spend a couple weeks there fixing these places up and cleaning them and raising money. And I really couldn't figure out why I was doing this, but I next thing I know, my higher power has me on a plane, and I'm flying up to Ketchikan or Juneau to work in these shelters. And sometimes I would be sitting on the runway, and it's like, I don't know why I'm doing this, God. I really can't afford to be away from my business for this long, but I don't know why I'm doing this, and I kept doing it. And one thing I didn't share, I grew up in a very alcoholic home with a lot of abuse. And I used to, my mom would get I can't believe I'm getting emotional about this. My mom would be the recipient of this abuse, and my sisters would. And I was just a little kid. For some reason, I never got beat because I was the boy, I guess. And I would have to listen to this. I would get locked in a room and I would have to hear it. My mom's voices and stuff. So anyways, 4 years after this, after my last trip up to Alaska, I realized, wow, I haven't heard my mom's voice screaming in the other room for years. And that was my gift. Because I couldn't do anything when I was 5 years old, But as an adult man, I was doing something to address this domestic violence stuff. I was like, I was paying homage to my mom as an adult man. And the gift that I got was that part of my past quit haunting me. It just quit haunting me. It was like a non-issue. And I realized it wasn't the shelters that were benefiting from me going up there. It was me. I'm the one that got the gift from being of service. And those two kind of moments of clarity were what made me realize that this thing is about a higher power. This the whole purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is to bring us to having a higher power. Whatever that isn't anybody's business, but I could not stay sober without a higher power. And I love the way the book, I'll say a couple other things. What do I talk for an hour, right? I'll say a couple other things. I have nothing against organized religion today. I used to. I don't today. The book says we are quick to find where religious people are right, and I'm come to that point. But I remember as a kid, we were really poor, and I remember on Saturdays you used to have to go to catechism. And I used to go to catechism, and they would have, and I was from public schools, and so the classroom would be mixed with kids from catechism and from public schools. And what the nuns would do, and a lot of these kids were very poor, they were hungry, what the nuns would do, they would give a glass of milk and cookies to the kids that attended the Catholic schools and skip the public school kids. And I'm thinking, today I'm thinking, man, that is fucked up. I'm thinking, that cannot be God. That cannot be God. There is something so wrong with this picture. And I was like 6 or 7 then. There is something so wrong with this picture to skip over little kids because they're not belonging to your church. It really offended me. And that stuck with me. And so I was raised Catholic, but for some reason I did not trust organized religion. I had other experiences when I realized I was gay. They had me, my parents sent me to this place where they try to deprogram you and teach you all of this scripture. Oh, you're an abomination, you're gonna burn in hell. And they're teaching you this all day long. And then two of those people molested me. And I'm thinking, well, now there's a mixed message. And there was another reason not to trust organized religion. I did not, but one thing that when I look back on this, I always had a deep underlying faith in a God, always. And I never blamed God for any of those issues. It wasn't God that was skipping over those little kids with the milk. It was us, you know? And I'm grateful for that because I hadn't for years and years and years. The book talks about, you know, sometimes it's harder for someone that once had a God in their life and left. It's sometimes harder for them to re-invite that into their lives than someone that's never had it at all. I'm paraphrasing, but the book says something like that. And I was that man the book talks about, full of faith yet reeks of alcohol. I believed in a God. I remember the first time I went into a meeting and all the God stuff, some lady shared, you know, I'm having a really hard time with the God stuff. And I thought, I got this licked. I believed in God my whole life. Well, that lady proceeded to stay sober and I could not. I could not stay sober. And so I love the way that the big book, you know, a God as we understand him, I think that's one of the most important phrases in our literature and in our steps. Because I think that has allowed more people to find their own higher power than any other word. Because when they told me I am allowed to have a God that I understand, that's when I was able to have a relationship again with my higher power. That nobody was telling me what it was and what it wasn't, and that you're not, the way you're believing in this is right or the way you're believing in this is wrong. I got to do it myself. It's hard for me to argue with my own understanding. And when I started to do that, I started to, I'll just say this, my challenge when I got here wasn't finding a God, it was building a trust with the God and building a relationship with a higher power. That was my challenge, because the way I viewed God is like, yes, I believe you, but I'll see you on my dying day, and I'm going to deal with the details. I'll handle the details of my life. That's how, that was the extent of my spiritual life. And the way I handled the details, I always drove the bus in the ditch. That's the way I handled the details of my life as an addict and an alcoholic. So for me to start to trust in a higher power, when I remember when my sponsor told me, I loved my sponsor. When I came in, he always asked me, everyone, did you talk to God today? And I'd say, yes. Well, I was lying. I was just saying a little prayer and checking in, but I wasn't talking to God. I thought that was weird. I thought it was weird to have a relationship with a higher power. And today, I have a really great relationship with a higher power. And I used to be so uncomfortable when people would talk about the topic to be your higher power. That used to make me so uncomfortable. Today I'm very comfortable with that, because it's the most important thing in my life. To go from, you know, was Ray at the meeting? Which Ray? Relapse Ray. To go from that to being asked to speak at a roundup, that's God. That's not, I didn't have anything to do with that. My higher power had everything to do with that. And I love the way that I took a workshop this year, and it was so great. It's this lady Nisi in Santa Barbara. She's awesome. She created a workshop. She used to work up with on the Joe and Charlie tape. She worked with Joe and Charlie. She's 45 years sober, and she didn't like that they didn't bring their workshop to Watts. She grew up in Watts, and they said, well, some people can't afford that, and that offended her. And so she created her own workshop with the big book, and she went to World Service and presented it to them. And they picked it apart for 6 months, and they approved her workshop. And so it's an incredible workshop. It's a big commitment. It's a 12 to 13 week commitment, 2 hours a week, but she picks apart the big book. And I learned so much from her. This last year, she actually had the workshop in my home. And a couple of things that I learned from that, because like the chapter The Agnostic, for years I would not pay attention when they read that, because it's like, oh, that don't apply, I don't believe in God. I love that chapter. There is so much in the chapter The Agnostics that apply to me today. And so it's about being open-minded and being teachable, staying teachable. I want to always remain teachable, because I learned more this year about the big book than I had in the last 13 years. And some of them was and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not a big book thumper and can tell you the pages and stuff, but where it talks about, you know, we assume that the big book says, we assume the reader wants to quit drinking. You have to start there. You know, you have to want to quit drinking. But if you've been beat up enough to be willing enough to say, maybe there's a higher power. Just they talk about that key of willingness, just to turn the lock and open it, that is sufficient enough to let's get to work. And it was pointed out, it's like, it's kind of bullshit when you say, I'm stuck on the God thing. You don't, if you're willing enough to just say, maybe, then let's get to work and let's do the rest of the steps, because it's in the rest of the steps where your faith is developed, or you find it even. And I love that. I love that concept, because I used to hear people with 30, 40, 50 years saying, I do steps 1, 2, and 3 every day. And it's like, why? And it's like, today I get why. I do steps 1, 2, and 3 every day too. So it's like, how can you get, when people come in and say, I'm stuck on the third step, you can't really be stuck on a step that you're never going to be done with. Never. And I love the way she explained that, because it's like, if somebody's willing to, you know, borrow my God, I get that. I don't buy the whole doorknob thing. I don't buy the whole tree thing. I buy the group, the Alcoholics Anonymous, is a power greater than myself, but I don't think a doorknob is a power greater than myself. What if somebody comes and knocks that doorknob off? What the hell are you going to do? You have to have a power greater than yourself. And I don't know, I've sat in these rooms long enough. I've been sitting in these rooms for 37 years, and I've sat and observed enough people come in and say, I'm struggling with the God thing, only for a year later to hear them talk very openly about the connection that they have with their higher power. And it's like, how does that happen? How does that happen? And I that's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. It's, to me, it's the closest it's the only thing where I see a tangible proof of God is in the rooms of alcoholics. I see proof in these rooms. I see someone come in, tore up from the floor up, and you know, in a year down the road, they're helping people and they're gone through their steps and they're passing it on. That is a power greater than myself. And I've witnessed that over and over and over, and that's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm very grateful. I right now I'm going through something where I've had the same home group for 13 and a half years at my Alano Club, and I'm switching it up. I have to, every now and then, I have to switch it up. There's a few things that happened, and, let me say this. I was in a meeting about a month and a half ago in Santa Barbara, and this girl said, sometimes I'm too spun out to figure out how to connect with my God and to how to pray, and so I've come up with this prayer that helps me, and all it is God, find me. And I thought, ooh, I like that. I'm going to use that someday. I really like that. Find me. Well, little did I know, 2 days later, I had a fight with my partner. We never fight. I had a really big fight with my partner. Something happened at the Alano Club where it was clear. Something was so against the traditions, which really bugged me. And I was really upset. So I was in a really vulnerable place. And all of a sudden, I haven't had the obsession, or I haven't thought about drinking or using in 13 years, and all of a sudden it was full volume. Full volume. And the book talks about the day will come where the only thing between me and a drink is my spiritual connection, and that was that day. And that was a couple months ago. I wanted to get loaded so bad, and that hasn't happened to me. And I know the talk that goes on. For somebody that was in and out for 24 years, I know the talk that goes on before I pick up. And that talk was full volume. Full volume. And I was sitting at the beach, and I was either going to go to the liquor store. I didn't know what I wanted to get loaded that bad. And I felt like I had no power. And I remembered that prayer. And I said, find me. God, please find me. And all of a sudden, my phone rang. And it was my partner, and we kind of made up on the phone, and that turned the temperature down. And then I got a call from a kid that I sponsor, and he goes, are we still meeting today? We meet every Saturday. We meet in a park in Ojai, and I'm all, yeah, we're still meeting. And I went over, and I met him in this park, and we were actually going through the traditions. And while we're going through the traditions, it's a really big park, and it was kind of early. I get a tap on my shoulder, and it's this guy, and he goes, excuse me, guys. He goes, I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but are you guys in recovery? I mean, we have our big book out. We have our 12 and 12. I'm all, yeah, we are. He goes, well, I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but he goes, and he just started crying. And he said, I had 2.5 years, and I relapsed about a month ago, and he had a 12-pack, and he's sitting in a park, and it's early in the morning. He goes, and I can't get back in the rooms. And it's like, I needed to see that guy. I needed to see the demoralization on his face. I needed to see the fear in his eyes. I needed to see the desperation in his, I needed to hear the desperation in his voice. And some people may say, that call from your partner, wow, you're lucky, that was a coincidence. Or that guy walking up to you in the park, that was a coincidence. None of that's God. To me, that is God. That is my higher power doing for me what I can't do for myself. And as soon as I saw this guy, and I gave him my number, and we've talked since, he's not ready, but it's like the sail got back up, and I'm okay now, But it taught me a lesson, because I haven't had the obsession or even thought to get loaded in 13 years, I thought, I'm good. I have to be on my guard every day. This is a 24-hour little box that I have to take care of. I cannot stay sober on yesterday's meeting. I'm that kind of an alcoholic. I remember the first time 30-something years ago, I heard my sponsor said, I want you to do 90 and 90. And I thought, I'm not very good at math, but he certainly can't mean a meeting a day. That would be ridiculous. I've been doing 90 and 90 for 13 and a half years. Sometimes I do more than that. I do this thing every day, and it's like, so that was another thing that was, every time I came back into the rooms after relapsing, I would sit down, I was demoralized, I had a desire to not drink, but in the back of my mind, I always thought, but I'm not sure this is a forever thing. I had that reservation, I had that great obsession that someday Ray's gonna be able to drink like a normal person. I always had that until that spiritual experience I had in that meeting. And there was no doubt, there was no more debate. And that's when my life changed. When my heart opened and I surrendered to that. You know, they really mean it when they say the only step you have to do perfectly is the first step. That when I did that step as perfectly as I could, my life changed as far as the trajectory of my recovery in these rooms. I did not feel like I had to get loaded anymore. So I'm forever grateful. I sponsor a lot of people. That is definitely a highlight of my life, especially since I've retired. I have more time to do that. I like to work with people right out of the book. I like to take them through the first 164 pages. I never sponsor, and some people may have a controversy with this. I don't really care because it's my boundary. It's not. I never sponsor more than six people because I don't want to have so many sponsors that I don't give them enough time. I spend an hour a week with them, taking them through the book, and I don't want to have so many, just another notch on my belt for sponsees. I do have what, you know, you end up having high maintenance and low maintenance. When they're brand new, they're high maintenance. They need a lot of help. But I don't want to sponsor someone if I don't have the time to dedicate that it takes to take them through the book and take them through the steps and take them through the first 164 pages, I don't really have any business sponsoring them. Not just to, you know, people that I sponsor know I sponsor them. and I know that I sponsor them, if you know what I'm trying to say. So I'm really grateful to be asked to do this. This is an honor to do this. I've been to many, many conventions, and the only way I participated in them is I always got that book. The youngest, newest newcomer, I got the newest newcomer big book 4 years in a row in this convention in Santa Barbara, 4 years in a row. And finally, the fourth year, this lady goes, "Are you ever going to get it?" She said that to me right up on stage, and she got a lot of flack for that, but I needed to hear that. I needed to hear that. And so to go from there to being asked to speak at a roundup is a huge, huge privilege. It's a huge privilege, and I contribute that to my higher power. So I'm really grateful to be asked. Thank you, Sharon, for asking me to do this. And I think that's all I have, so thank you for letting me share.